Station number 14983, Albert Shippen, reel 10.
Mr. A. Shippen, reel 10. When you completed your leave, Mr. Shippen, what happened to you next?
Well, we were all reported back to Bransford, but instead of going into what they called the training company, we went into what they called the holding company. Now, the holding company was for trained soldiers and also for members of the Durham Light Infantry, mostly, who had come back from war theatres, had been on wire list, had been downgraded and that, and were waiting for postings. We then, as the trained soldiers had been finished, every now and again, were put into drafts and were sent up into Northumberland to a little village called Felton. This was run under the officers of the 10th Duke of Wellington Battalion, which was a training battalion. It was on the periphery of Chevy Chase, as we know that, the Cheviot Hills. It belonged to 49th Division, and the divisional sign was a triangle with a square with a parrot in it. And that was the training unit. Now, one of its objectives was, apart from being the battle initiative for people who had become trained soldiers, it was also situated in the area known as Drewridge Bay, where there was a possible site for beach landings if there was an invasion into the United Kingdom. And if you look at that and you look at the map, you could see where, if there was a beach landing, they could cut the country into quite quickly by going from the Drewridge Bay area, which was and cutting across cutting across to Carlisle, and therefore establishing the bridgehead and isolating Scotland from the remainder of the United Kingdom. Though that was probably secondary in the minds, there was a training division permanently stationed in that area. Now, we as infantry did 6 weeks battle training on the Cheviot Hills. We fired most of the weapons, the 3-inch mortar, we did carrier training, signalling, but also we did creeping barrages with the artillery on the Cheviot Hills. But on top of all of that, it was endurance, because you used to go out on your last week on the Monday morning, and you went through all the exercises firing live ammunition under supervision, right from the section attack right away through to the battalion attack. And at the end of that, you then were given the presentation of an infantry battalion's firepower. All the weapons in an infantry battalion were firing into an area to show you what support was given to you as an infantryman in your battalion.
What was firing into the area?
Well, you had the PIAT, which was the Projector Infantry Anti-Tank Weapon, which was an hideous weapon. It was like a 4-inch drain pipe with a chunk cut out the end. It had a shoulder put on it, but the spring in it was probably about a half an inch in diameter, and you had to put this confounded contraption between your legs and pull the thing up so that the spigot came through, and then you put a missile in it, which was like a big grenade at the front with a tail fin on it. There was a hole through the tail fin. This spigot used to be about, I would think, about 3/4 in diameter. It used to come up into the missile and shoot out. I think its range, if I remember rightly, was about 120 yards. And it had a fuse on the front of it. And it would explode practically at the least touch. But the fundamental principle behind it, at 120 yards or so, which was its maximum, the was to disarm tanks. And of course, apparently it said that all the blast from this missile went into the tank, and therefore was a superb tank weapon. But you had to stand up or lie down, obviously, to cock the damn thing, and 9 times out of 10 you could get shot. I remember reading during the Northwest Europe campaign after D-Day that a guardsman got the VC for firing this weapon from the hip and knocking out the tank. We should have all got the VC for trying to fire the confounded thing to start with. Then we had the by then we had the 6-pounder anti-tank weapon. We had a different feed into some of the Bren guns. Instead of having a 28-mm mag, we had a magazine. We had a drum which carried about 100 rounds. They had some of them twinned, which was for anti-aircraft, but we, of course, people were developing them for all sorts of things by then. But the other thing to remember was that the bolt-action rifle at that time, and probably the British Army, was very proficient in the bolt-action weapon. And also, it's more or less conserved your ammunition. And as you used to say in those days, make every shot count. But it was a tremendous thing to see a battalion's weapon being fired. And I remember on one occasion, I went to see this demonstration, and this copse that they fired into, which was the fire zone and this kind of thing, and everyone was told to come forward by the demonstration people and this kind of thing, and there out of the copse came a pheasant with its brood of chicks after the battalion had put all its firepower into it. So it was a bit of a laugh. People said, well, if the pheasant will live, so will the enemy. But in the 6 weeks we did river crossing, and while I was there we lost 10 people in a boat at which is now a leisure park up in Northumberland at Aggerston Castle. We used to use their lake to do boatmanship in these collapsible canvas boats, and for some unknown reason we used to use the cork at the river as well. And this boat, although there were safety lines across in this kind of thing, unfortunately went over a weir, and with the men wearing the pouches and the small packs and everything and that, that when they went over the weir, they were dragged down and the whole 10 that was in the boat were lost. As I say, that was the battle kind of thing where majority of things were done live firing. You went and did the peat, you did the grenades and that again, you fired the mortars, and you fired the Stirlings, you did also Japanese warfare, walking through jungle where the target would appear and you would engage the target in the scanning. You also did your mine clearing, you had all these kind of things which were bringing you to perfection while you were being trained, but this was to give you the final polish in those 6 weeks. After the 6 weeks...
Period of time was this?
You had 6 weeks to do it.
What date?
Oh, well, that was from when I went up there. It would be about 44 or thereabouts, but it had been going on long before that. And that went right on to the end of the Second World War, which was the, August or so in 45. But it had been the battles. Because in that division, you then went on to specialists. People were selected to do specialist training. They had all these little villages along Framlington and Castle Morpeth and all those kind of things, Rothbury, and that dotted around the area as well, which was your front line and your second line kind of thing if they were coming in to do a bayonet, and then your backup services. But you had, you went, while you did your 6 weeks training, you had the wasp carrier and that give you a demonstration. But after you'd done your 6 weeks, you could then be selected to go into the specialist arm of your infantry battalion, which was your Bren gun carriers, which had your 3-inch mortars on, we had a tank, your signalling, and such jobs as that, assault pioneers. And that, then you went after you'd finished your 6 weeks training, and there again, because of the our ages, we were backlogged again, or we had to do bugling duty or police work or things of that nature, because we weren't old enough at that period of time to be posted overseas. People could come into the army and give the wrong ages in this kind of thing, and slip the net and get abroad. But because we were joined as boys and we had to produce our birth certificates, and all our documentation said that I was born on June the 18th, 1927, there was no way that I could falsify my my age. So every time the draft was organised in this kind of thing to go anywhere, if it was an overseas draft, we would be eliminated. From the draft entirely, and held in the Holden Company.
So you were still bugling from time to time?
Oh, yes, yes. Well, we were offered on numerous occasions to go to different units and this kind of thing, and even to return to Bransworth. But I felt as though I'd had enough of that kind of thing. And I was a regular soldier, and I joined the army, and it was going to be my work, as I say today, it's a profession. I don't think we would have called it a profession in those days to that extent. But I had to look forward to my promotion in the battalion and this kind of thing. I didn't want to be a bugler all my life. I'd done years at bugling and this kind of thing, and I enjoyed it. But I wanted to move on into the battalion.
Were you given any specialist training yourself in other... skills?
Well, I was in the machine guns in the 1st Battalion. I was with the Wasps, that's the Bren guns and this kind of thing, for a while. And being the bugle major, I was the defence platoon commander of Battalion HQ. My responsibility was, you had the forward companies and everything like that. But the underbelly of the battalion was where the command officer was, the command post, the RAP, the regimental aid post, and etc., and what have we. So it was developed that on a number of occasions that when the enemy had broke through, they found the battalion headquarters weren't defended, because the people that were in there were specialists. They were on wireless sets and they were cooking and what have we. So to give it a secondary role to the bugle section, we became the defence platoon of the battalion HQ, and my job as well was more or less bodyguard to the commanding officer. I remember on one exercise we did in Germany later on, we're on this huge exercise, one of the biggest exercises that took place after the Second World War. Shinwell was the Minister of War, as he was known in those days, and Montgomery and Le Tachinier, the French guy, was visiting units. We were in a quarry, I can't remember what part of Germany, but it must have been in the Sennelager area, Bielefeld area, where we did a lot of this training. And all of the Rhine Army was on this exercise. And just to put the thing in the right perspective, before we went on this exercise, the Rhine Army passed in review through the Ministry of War. And I was the senior bugle major, drum major, pipe major, whatever you would like to call it, in the Rhine Army at the time. And I led the mass bands of the Rhine Army, which was about 700 strong, past this Edinburgh parade, which had everything in it, tanks, artillery, RSC columns, and you name it. It was a huge thing. It must have took some a couple of hours to pass the saluting base. Anyway, after the march past that, I then had to revert back to the role as being the defence platoon commander, as the battalion took up its position in the exercise, and the band mercifully shot off back to barracks, because in the role that they played, they were responsible for the protection of the barracks and the married families that was left behind, and the rear guard. So we went into our role in the exercise of Rhine Army, and as the defence platoon, I put my people into the defence positions. We dug slit trenches, we dug command post pits, and I think we had sentries on the entrance to the quarry and what have you. And the colonel had one of these great massive Humber staff cars. We had about half a ton, great huge thing. It was, and he had decided to go and get his head down. Anyway, unknown to us, down came the staff car, flying the pennant of Field Marshal Montgomery. The sentries on the gates, being proper Geordies, where's he? So we decided that he was somebody important, so we better go and investigate. So the adjutant, who was a chap called Captain Gilly Morn, nice chap, we soon discovered it was Montgomery and Le Tachinier, the French general. So he asked Montgomery, everyone presented arms and paid the compliments, and he asked where the commanding officer was. So he was told that the commanding officer was at his staff car. So the adjutant turned around to me and said, would you go and get the commanding officer and tell him that Field Marshal Montgomery was here? So saluted, and off I went to the staff car, knocked on the staff car window and said to the colonel, Colonel, we have visitors, Field Marshal Montgomery and a chap called, a French general called Le Tachinier. Ah, came the reply, Bugle Major, give the Field Marshal my compliments and tell him I'm resting while there's a lull in the battle. Sir, off I doubled back, very smartly back, saluted Montgomery, and said, sir, message from the commanding officer. He's resting while there's a lull in the battle. Montgomery turned round and said to Le Tachinier, you see, one of my officers, I trained him, bloody good bloke, carries out, you see. Why should a commanding officer be awake when there's no bloody necessity? A few minutes later, the commanding officer appeared on the scene, and Montgomery walked over and said, hello, Michael, how are you? Glad to keep up your training. And all of us were stood there amazed with Monty's action, and the colonel stood there calm, cool and collected, and answered every question without any provocation.
Who was the colonel?
The colonel was Colonel Michael Anmer, and he commanded the 11th Battalion that I know of in Normandy and that, and had a very good war record, but it was obvious that Montgomery at some time or other had met him. And of course, Monty had always said, you know, these kind of things, these little things. When he committed his 8th Army, he went off to bed. There was nothing else he could do. So he was more or less saying, he said to his officers and this kind of thing. That's it. Another little story I can tell you, if you've got time to listen, is we had an officer and a gentleman called Harry Law. And he was a ranker and had made quartermaster and was one of the first lieutenant colonel quartermasters in the Durham Light Infantry. And as he was getting on in age, he was seconded to Montgomery's headquarters in the Middle East. And one night I was at a regimental dinner with Harry Law, and he was telling me this story, that at some period or other, when they were in the Western Desert, Montgomery gave authority and an instruction that all his headquarters would be issued with gas masks. So the quartermaster indented for the gas masks and duly appeared on the scene with his wares. And Montgomery said that all officers and staff personnel would be fitted with the gas masks at the quartermaster's location at such and such a time. So Montgomery duly arrived and had his gas mask fitted, and so did the officers and all the rest of the staff and everything in his HQ over the period of time. Eventually a batman appeared on the scene and said to Harry Law, "Colonel so-and-so-and-so-and-so wants you to go to so-and-so-and-so-and-so with a selection of gas masks so they can have them fitted." Unfortunately for the colonel, this fell on the ears of Montgomery. And Montgomery apparently turned around and said, "If I can go and have my bloody gas mask fitted, he can have his gas mask fitted." So immediately sent for him and told him he didn't need to have his gas mask fitted, to pack his kit and leave his headquarters.
I don't know, he didn't give the name of the colonel.
No, I didn't. But he had lots of little stories. He told me another one, which I suppose would be interesting to certain people. He was at a dinner one night, and at the dinner was Boyd Bradford's brother. And I think his name was Thomas Bradford. And he said, after the dinner, Thomas Bradford came across to him and said to him, "Harry, look after this," and passed the case across to him. So Harry said, "Righto, I'll do that." He says, when he'd gone and everything that, he says, "I looked around and I remembered this case and I picked it up." He says, "So I opened it to see what was inside of it, and there was Boyd Bradford's original VC. So that's how the regiment got presented with Boyd Bradford's VC. He was a wonderful chap, and he had loads and loads of stories to tell.
To come back to what you were doing after the 6 weeks training that you had there, what happened to you?
Well, I stayed in the old unit for a while, and then there was an army order came out or something. It was called Sir Wonko, and that meant surplus to war office establishment. And as you can see, the war was coming to a close, and the army was retracting into its peacetime role and this kind of thing. So the each regiment obviously was looking for its potential senior ranks and its officers and that to come up in the building, because each regiment, or foot regiments in those days, had two battalions, the 1st and the 2nd battalion. So they were looking for their own kith and kin, which was spread throughout the length and breadth of the world, really. Different people on different jobs. And obviously, with us being not old enough to be sent to any European theatre of war, and we'd been at the 10th Duke of Wellington Battalion, I suppose it irked the Durham Light Infantry that we were bugling up there for the 10th Duke of Wellington Battalion. So by some quirk or other, we were posted, reposted back to regimental headquarters. And I suppose being enlisted in those days, which you did, into the Durham Light Infantry, they had first call on you. And under the circumstances, I don't suppose we could refuse to do anything but return to our regimental quarters. Then again, we took up the duties as bugling, both at the camp again and at the castle. But I pestered the company commander, Captain Walker, who was a school teacher from Bishop Auckland, that much, that eventually, as soon as I was able to be sent abroad, that he put me on the draft to go. But before that, I tried to get out a different way, and I volunteered for the parachute regiment, and I got through all my training and everything till I got to the jump school at Ringway. There was a tremendous backlog of people waiting to jump, and because of inclement weather, and the RAF more or less took no more intakes into the, because they were the instructors, and you went there and you came under the RAF at the jump school at Ringway, and that, unfortunately, I got a tummy bug and was dispatched off to hospital, and for some unknown reason, after I'd been in hospital for over 3 weeks in this kind of thing, I was put on what they call the Y list, and instead of being returned to the parachute regiment, I was returned once again to the depot at Bransforth.
Where did you do your initial training that you said you did prior to going to the jump school?
Oh, Hardwick Hall, outside Chesterfield. That was the depot of the parachute regiment in those days. And you went there and you did 6 weeks training, and you went through all the tests, see the trick cyclists and the psychologists and what have we. But also it was very arduous because you really doubled everywhere you went, and you had to pass these physical training standards without any to do. I think you would start off with an intake about 300 people, and you were lucky if 75 went to jump school. And not only that, because it was a voluntary service, people could ask to be returned to unit as well. They'd made a mistake, but you very rarely got to jump school unless they wanted you to go to jump school, and they knew you would jump because they didn't want to waste the time with you.
So the psychiatrist was to see what if you were a person who would jump.
Yes. Oh yeah. I remember we went in into a classroom, and they had like an audience board kind of thing. And what they did was they give it a pencil and paper, and they said, right, I want you to write down the first thing that comes into your mind once you see this word. And like, say, for instance, the word butter. So you would put down, say, I saw butter, I put down knife. They'd put down fish, you could put down chips. And this guy, it was your first thing, and you didn't get any time to consider the thing. It was the first reaction that came to your mind and what you wrote down. Those papers went into these people, and then on occasions you'd see them being called forward, and this kind of, then they went in to see the trick cyclists and the psychologists in this kind of, and then the next morning, every morning there was a parade, and you heard the names of those that were unfortunate that were RTU'd by the trick cyclist or by the medical officer or by the physical training people that was there. But it was a nerve-wracking experience to stand there morning after morning. And at the end of your 6 weeks, We used to have in the infantry, in our, the Dermot Infantry anyway, we used to have a blanco called Blanco Number 3, which was a filthy, horrible, khaki-looking blanco. And it was in a powder form, and you wet your weapon, and you dusted this powder on, and you rubbed it in to your weapon, you see. And the parachute regiment had a pea green colour, which you had a like a block of blanco, you see. So at the bottom of this hill, there was a pond, and we called it Blanco Lagoon. And when we got our berries, not our wings, we got our berries, everybody marched down there and threw his tin of number 3 blanco in there, so we called it Blanco Lagoon.